And if you have it at any time, have any questions, yeah. Or if you want to stop and get a drink of water or whatever, just
drink off the other side of the cup.
Okay, just let me give a little announcement as to where we are and what day it is, and then I'll start out with some of the questions, and we'll again try to remember about the invisible interview.
Yes, but that I should start the subject and verb to the sentence, right. Sort of thing.
Like that, yeah. Mm. And if there is a problem, if I don't catch it, I'm sure Ralph will, and we can.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of doing these things.
Yeah.
This is Barry Tyker of the UW Oral History Project. It is the Ides of March.
It is March 15th, 1990.
I'm at WHA Studios, and I'm interviewing Mrs. Janet Smith Ela, who was an undergraduate here in the late 1920s. Well, you can give us that information. Why don't you start out by stating your name and the years you attended UW?
My name is Janet Smith Ela. And I entered the university in the fall of 1926 and graduated in June of 1930.
Were you from Madison?
Yes, I was Madison born, one of the few natives around here. I had finished high school in February of that year, but my father wisely thought it would be much better to join a full class. So I had my first job selling at the university bookstore, which was then called the Co-op. That time it was farther away from the campus, up near the corner of Gilman and State. And because I was the youngest member of the staff, when we made the move farther down, I was the one who cleaned the glass showcases with ammonia. That was a pleasant job.
And what made you decide to attend UW?
Well, I think it was probably the financial situation. My
context.
There were two sisters. My older sister was a year ahead of me, and I don't believe the family felt they could afford to send us to an Eastern college or other such options. So we just naturally attended. Also, both my parents were graduates of the University of Wisconsin, and my maternal grandfather was. So we were holding a tradition.
Any tradition in terms of the English major?
No, I don't think that I had any special. My interest had been in writing. Actually, I had rather strong interest in art, but the art department here was relatively weak, and my father said, get a good general academic education, and maybe we could send you on to art school later. But that didn't happen.
Now, you talk as though your father knew something about the university.
He certainly should have, because while he was an undergraduate, he had worked in the library, which was then in Music Hall, called Library Hall at that time. And then when he graduated in 1890, he became the first full-time librarian. Before that, various faculty members had taken turns sort of staffing it, but there had not been a librarian. And he was, of course, this was before the days of library science as a skill. He had not had any of that, but it was really a very learned person. I remember being impressed that he had Sanskrit among other subjects in his career. And so then he was the librarian until he retired in 1936, I believe it was.
Okay, we'll get back to him just a little bit later on. Now, when you came on campus in the fall of 1930, and actually you were around campus before that as working at the co-op.
Yeah.
What kind of facilities were available for, let's start first with women, what kind of facilities were available for women in terms of for socializing activities, et cetera?
There were several dormitories, but of course I lived at home for most of my career. I did join a sorority, and they played a more active role in the campus life. That is, a proportion of fraternity and sorority people was higher to the total university membership numbers. I lived at the house one semester only of the 8 semesters I was in college, and I enjoyed it, but I think I liked the privacy of being at home and also having more diverse friends in. I had friends who I were not quite sure would be comfortable coming to dinner at the sorority house, where they would be at my family's house.
What about Lathrop Hall? Can you tell me about that?
Well, there were... I can't remember whether Lathrop was a live-in. Barnard and Chadburn, I think, were the two women's residence halls. Lathrop, at that time, had the gymnasium and the swimming pool and such things for women. It was loaded in women's activities, but I don't think it was a residence. I'm not sure.
If you lived in, let's say, Barnard or the old Chadburn we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, those were both right down there in the corner of Park and University, more or less.
It used to be called Ladies Hall, didn't it, the old Chadburn?
Maybe earlier, but yeah.
If you were, let's say you had been living, you had been a student from someplace north like Menominee, and you'd come down here and you'd moved into Barnard Hall, for your social activities, for things like gymnasiums and dances and things like that, before Memorial Union opened in the 1925, 26, 27 era, where would you have gone to find such activities?
I'm trying to think. I suppose Lathrop was the center of... There was, for instance, a group called the Women's Self-Government Association, and they had programs with freshmen and sophomore women, particularly discussion groups and things like that. I recall being on something called the Freshman Commission. It was freshman women who were chosen to then go on and go into leadership positions. And we had, I think there were a good many meeting rooms in that building. I suppose the dormitories had their social events, and though I knew very little of the dormitory life.
Now you mentioned the WSGA,
yes.
The Self-Government Association. I noticed on your resume that you had been a member of that. Now, as when you were in these leadership conferences or seminars, describe what that would have been like, what it was like.
It's quite hard for me to reconstruct them. I think there were discussion groups.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. There were discussion groups on probably political and historical subjects, but I cannot seem to dredge those out.
Perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
Now, across campus, where the old president's right next to, between the YMCA. Well, let's talk about the YMCA before we get to building a memorial.
Yes.
The YMCA, where the parking lot is now next to
yes,
the
Yes, between the Union and the
what
Red
can
Gym.
Can you tell me about what you know about the YMCA in those early days?
I don't think I had any affiliations with YMCA. There was a campus YWCA, and I think it was stationed in Lathrop.
That wasn't for housing, living, though.
No, I really don't believe there were residence rooms in Lathrop, but I may be mistaken on that.
I think you might be right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have the beginning of a monumental undertaking, the building of Memorial Union. Starting in, when did it start?
Oh, it was some years before I... The building committee for the Memorial Union, I think, must have been in the early 1920s, or perhaps even before that, as far as the initial planning. There was a fund drive when I was a freshman, which I think probably continued in my sophomore year, too. And a lot of us were roped into raising money and so on. I was simply one of a large crew of fundraisers, but the thing I remember most vividly is that when the union opened, which I believe was the beginning of my junior year, that would have been the fall of 28, there was no place where a girl student could go unescorted, except into a little parlor next to the women's washroom on the second floor. And it was decorated with Louis XVI furniture, a very unappetizing and unfriendly place. You couldn't go into the main hall. Of course, the Rathskeller was out of bounds for a good many years even, I think. That was men's territory only. You couldn't go into the great hall or any of the general rooms. So I think those of us who had thought this was an all-student union were pretty disaffected at that stage. I know I was, and I did not even quite finish my life membership. I had paid something in the first few years, and then after it opened, a small fee was part of our regular university semester fee. And I think I was probably, let's say $10 or $12 short of a life membership when I graduated. But I did not complete it at that time. I thought I was going to go off to New York City to seek my fortunes and didn't expect to be living in Madison. So I actually, when I came back I was married in January of 1938, and my husband, Alder, was a member of the union. So, of course, we bought tickets, concert tickets and plays and things of that sort on his membership, and it didn't even really occur to me that I was not a member until I was asked if I would be an alum member of the Student Council. And that, I think, must have been probably the fall of 53. And I accepted with pleasure. I thought that would be good fun. I think there were usually about four, perhaps two alums and two faculty people working with the students. And I knew I would enjoy those meetings, but I felt rather guilty. I thought, I've got to confess, I am not a member. So then I had to plunk out quite a bit more, because this was a non-student membership that I was taking.
So your negligence or your hesitance of paying the $12
that
cost you.
my resentment boomeranged, yes.
What did you and your friends think? I'm talking about your female friends. So what kind of conversations did you have about what you saw happening?
Oh, I think that all of the women were really quite put off.
Let's start that again. I've got a beating clock.
Yeah.
So I have to start over.
I don't recall conversations that we had explicitly, but I know there was a general feeling of disappointment that we had been double-crossed a little bit, thinking that this was going to be an all-student union, and then having so few public areas that we could be in at all. I suppose members of the cardinal staff or perhaps various committee things, those young women would be able to go up to their offices and be able to range a little bit farther than the little French parlor on the second floor. But I don't recall any. There was no groundswell of rebellion.
What led you to believe that you would be allowed into the union on equal footing, or at least on somewhat equal footing?
There was no definition of what our privileges would be. We just assumed that this was going to be a building open to all students and also to female alumni who became members. But I don't know when the change came about, because it may well have been during that first half of the 30s before I returned to Madison for full time.
Did, in terms of the fundraising, when you were raising funds, I'm going back a little further now, what did you do to raise funds for the union?
Oh, I suppose that I worked on members of my pledge class in the sorority, and
in context for fundraising,
trying to do fundraising. I don't remember any door-to-door going around through rooming houses or that sort of thing, though that may have been taken on by some people.
You said a word earlier, you mentioned one word in terms of where women could and couldn't go. You said unescorted. Now, what about being escorted?
Well, if you, there were dances at the union, and of course, if you had a date, you could go to dance in the Great Hall, or possibly there were sometimes lectures in the room, it's called the library now. See, all of this was long before the theater. The theater didn't open until 39, I think, was it? But the general meeting rooms, and of course what it's called, the lounge, I believe, that room up at the top of the stairs, and this would be the second floor. Men students could go in there, read the newspapers, and study, and just a general big parlor, but not the women.
Were there any incidents that you were aware of, even in terms of, like, just, you know, verbal exchanges between you and Porter Butts or men in the union regarding your displeasure?
Oh, I think that probably all of us registered some. I don't recall a conversation with Porter. I didn't know him very well. It was much later that I got to know him. But I was not a combative person by nature. I don't know whether there were some others who were more so. I just thought, well, let's just find my social life elsewhere.
Let me give you some names of people. Now, you may not know any of these people, but and if you don't, fine. Mm-hmm. You started out with Porter. Let me start out with Porter Butts.
Yeah.
Do you know any much? Did you have much
of? Oh, I did not know Porter while I was in college. He was probably about a college generation ahead of me. I've known Lowell Frauchy always because he was a Madison boy, and he was ahead of me in high school, but very much looked up to by the younger students. And I'd known him not well until later, but I'd known him.
What about James Watrous?
I've known Jim right along. I've known James Watrous. He went to a different high school, but I had known him, I think, probably from the time I was a sophomore on. His wife was already his girl. I think they were high school sweethearts, and Peg was a sorority sister of mine, and so I had known him through that channel. Also, I think he and I were in a life drawing class, one of the few art classes that I took while I was in the university.
Did you have any association with him in terms of the murals that he drew in?
No, I was not involved in James Watrous's murals.
What about Charles Dollard? Is he a
Charles Dollard is a familiar name, but I don't believe I actually knew him. His older brother, John Dollard, was also, I think, very active in the early years of the union planning.
Maybe I have the Dollards mixed up. Mm. I even have Walter Frauchy written down here instead of Lowell.
Yeah.
There are too many of these Frauchys. Yeah. What about President Burge?
I've known President Burge for many, many years. He was a friend of my grandparents, and he was a member of something called the Madison Literary Society, which is a, see, it had its 100th anniversary in the late 70s, I believe. And my grandfather and my father were both members, and in the early years, the club met in private houses. So when either my parents or grandparents were hosts, I sometimes passed cookies and lemonade after the meeting. So I'd known President Burge. Then years later, the house that I am still living in on Van Hise Avenue is just diagonally across the street from where the president lived long after he was retired then.
I'm going to do a little bit of fishing on some of this. Is based on some of the information that we got from Mr. Sfrouchy and Butts in the interviews with them. And if you can comment on any of these, fine. If you can't, that's certainly understandable. What can you tell me about the Iron Cross Society?
I know that Iron Cross by name as a, I think it was a senior honor society for men. There was a woman's society called Mortarboard. I believe they were equivalent honor societies based on, unlike Phi Beta Kappa, it was based on scholarship and participation in activities.
Did you know anything about the fact that I've heard talk about the Iron Cross being more or less, in a way, a secret society? They were very secretive about their activities, and they were very close to President Van Hise and his decision-making process. Do you know anything about that at all?
I've never known of Iron Cross as a secret society, though, as I say, my acquaintance with it was very nominal.
When the union was, the men's union, Memorial Union, was first being planned and designed, it was modeled in many ways after Oxford and Cambridge and their colleges in the European tradition. Were you aware of any of that type of modeling activity?
I don't think I've known what the origins of our union were. It surprises me that they were thinking in terms of English colleges, like the Oxford and Cambridge ones.
When they started building the union, there were some rather serious labor disputes that arose in terms of using non-union personnel to construct the building. Do you recall, there was actually a big confrontation with them between the non-union workers and the union workers that resulted in some serious property damage. Do you remember any of that?
My memory does not include any strikes in the union, in the process of the union building. I ought to be able to remember it because, of course, my path from where I lived on Langdon Street as a student was straight down State Street to climb up the hill. I should certainly have been aware of it, but I don't seem to recall.
In those very early years of the union, when it was just opening, what types of programs and activities were you involved with? Did you participate in as a student in the union?
I don't believe that my activities centered in the union at all. I wasn't on any of the Cardinal or the Badger yearbook or those things, which did, I think those were housed in the union. Um, I think I was doing other things besides going to classes, but I can't seem to visualize the settings for them.
Well, you were probably running over to your father's library and studying.
Yeah, not all the time was I studying, but
you described in rather interesting fashion the room where the women were shuffled off to as the Louis the whatever room. Were there any other rooms in the Union that stand out in your mind, your memory?
I can remember the Great Hall, and particularly those lozenges in the ceiling which come in and out as you look at them. They're ovals and circles with that op art effect of changing, withdrawing and projecting themselves. It was a very unpleasant room for watching anything on that little stage because it was so much wider than it was deep. That lounge, which I was sorry not to be in, was particularly unattractive in its furnishings as well. And I think the building, the fake Renaissance style of the building with that pompous stairway, is not what I would choose. I think probably a lot of the people associated with it would rather have a different style of building than the one that they ended up with.
What about that women's room? Did you ever use it? Did you ever go there much? Or did you go? Were there a lot of people, women, who used it?
Oh, no, it was not a place where you gathered at all. You just, the toilet rooms adjoined it, and occasionally if you were going to meet a friend, you'd come up and meet in this room, which was, I don't know whether that's still there or not. It was a room probably 25 to 30 feet square with the little open arm chairs and brocaded seats. And
well, if it's still there, I doubt if it's there in that state.
Yeah.
One other question about the Union. We'll leave that for a bit. What was the terrace like in the early days?
The terrace, which is such a lovely and much-used place now, I think had not been developed much in the first stages. I don't recall the metal chairs out there. Those must have come quite a little later. And, of course, just recently they've had a wonderful new development of the terrace, enlarging it and making it much more attractive. Nor do I remember when Hoofers came in, which became, of course, one of their strongest outing clubs. The great numbers of moored sailboats out there now, I don't believe, characterized the earlier years. In fact, sailboating had gone through a very strange period. There'd been apparently sailing way back in my father's time, and there was almost no sailing on Lake Mendota when I was a child.
Well, let us leave the Union for a few moments and go back to your schooling here at the university. You became, as we've mentioned, an English major. You were, let me call you fortunate, I think, to be an English major at a time when UW had a rather distinguished, certainly interesting English department. Could you talk about some of the professors you had and describe them and their...
Yes, I'm not sure that I will be able to describe the English department with the high points that you're asking for. For example, William Ellery Leonard, who was probably the most distinguished nationally, was, as you know, a rather eccentric person. I took a course probably about my junior year in beginning Anglo-Saxon, because the only course that Leonard was teaching at all to undergraduates by that time was Beowulf. And when I was then ready to enroll in Beowulf, my father said, no daughter of mine is going to be in a class with William Ellery Leonard. He had to chase him out of the library stacks too many times. And I wept almost and said, Father, there are going to be much more alluring girls in the class. I want a class. The answer was no. It's the only time my father had ever interfered with my course's choice of subjects. One of the most distinguished people was Neil Dodge, Robert Elkin Niels Dodge, who was the father of a very close friend of mine. And I had heard Julia say, oh, it embarrasses my father so when he has students he knows, family friends, in his classes. So I deliberately did not elect a class with him. Then I learned that Mr. Dodge was very hurt that Janet Smith had not chosen anything. So there were a few setbacks in my... I had several classes with Dean Rowe, who... I think he taught the general survey sophomore class. Oh, yeah. And then I had a class called Romantic Movement. And he was a great lover of Wordsworth, whom I disliked much less than Keats and Shelley and so on. And I thought poor Wordsworth had the worst sense of prosody of almost any of the group. I had a delightful course with Sonny Pyer, whose full name I've forgotten now, but he was also a family friend, in versification. And that made us feel very grown up, because it met Tuesdays and Thursday evenings at 7:30. And I found
James Francis Augustus.
Augustus Pyer. And I actually took more composition classes than straight literature classes, I believe. I had a class with Paul Fulcher and one with, oh, I cannot think of her name, a woman who was excellent teacher in narrative writing. My freshman English class was with Warner Taylor, who was head of the freshman program. And if one could take a test at the end of the first semester and skip the second semester. But I found him such an interesting teacher that I kept down in that rather than skipping the second round. You have some other names?
Well, there were a couple of young assistant professors who later on gained quite a following on campus. I'm talking about Helen C. White and Ruth Wallerstein. Did you have either one?
I didn't have them in class. I knew both of them. And again, that was... I knew them through Medlet Society rather than in school.
Now, you said you took a lot of more writing courses. So your aim was more toward literature?
Yes, I hope to be a professional writer. And in my New York working days, I used my skills, I would not say to any great fame, but I...
You were an editor, weren't you?
I worked in a literary agency, and then I was in the decorating department of McCall's magazine, doing a lot of ghostwriting for the editor of that department.
So how would you characterize the quality of your undergraduate education in terms of the English department?
I think that... My feeling that my English major was satisfactory. It was certainly perfectly well taught, but I don't believe I had professors in that department that excited me as much as several others outside. I especially remember E.B. McGilvery in the philosophy department, who was a... He didn't have the large lecture classes that Max Otto gave at the time, but he was a kind of teacher who made you absolutely fool-averse all your... had to question all of your thinking. And the wonderful teacher in the history department, Carl Stevenson, who was the best lecturer I've ever known anywhere. It was, you just went like a movie serial to find out what was going to happen next.
Were they still giving Skyrockets then?
Yes, I don't remember them very often except with Kiekhofer. Can't think of his first name. Bill Kiekhofer.
Yeah, Wild
yeah,
Bill
yeah. And he had that enormous beginning econ class in music hall, I believe it was. Enormous class. And he usually had the Skyrockets. I can't seem to hear them in other classes.
And were they usually delivered at the beginning or the end or both?
The Skyrocket was probably at the end. They may have sometimes been at the beginning.
I'm going to have to ask you, because we're going to have people listening to this and they're not going to know what we're talking about.
Oh.
Can you do, what will you say when you say a Skyrocket?
Boom, oh, please! Isn't that the Skyrocket? I think.
I believe it is.
It doesn't sound very good with one voice only. You have to have a mob.
And that is, I believe, a sign of respect, right?
Oh, yes, it's high praise.
Did you wear a green cap when you were a freshman?
Green cap, I think, was for men only.
It was.
I don't think any of the girls don't see the green cap.
Any initiation ceremonies similar to that for women?
The sororities had initiation ceremonies, but I don't think there was an overall campus.
Was that associated with Rush, those initiations?
Rushing in the Greek letter societies, it occurs in the fall when they are choosing pledges. And then the initiation is usually in middle of the second semester.
What type of initiation things did you have to go through, or would a typical sorority have gone through?
I don't recall that we had any hazing. The men's fraternity initiations, I think, did. We did not have any trials and punishments and that sort of thing.
No swallowing goldfish or
anything? No.
What about speakeasies? This was time of bootleg.
This was before. I was during prohibition, and I was so naive that if occasionally at a fraternity party there would be some rather strange tasting punch, which I thought had some spoiled oranges.
Tasted remarkably good.
I think it was, it must have been in about the spring of 32 when I was working in New York, and I had a letter, or probably a news clipping, from someone in Madison saying that the sororities had got together to agree on their approved speakeasies or something of that sort, but...
Yeah, I had heard several people say that Little Italy, which is the Regent Street area, had housed several speakeasies. I was wondering, have you ever actually been in a speakeasy?
The only speakeasies I was ever in were in New York City a couple of times, but none in Madison.
Clubs and organizations. Before we get off of sororities, let's stay in sororities. Where was your sorority house located?
On Langdon Street, the Delta Gammas, Langdon and Carroll. And my family's home was 127 Langdon, half a block toward campus from there.
Oh, so you were really close.
Yeah.
Even when you lived at the sorority house, you lived close to
home.
Yeah. there were sorority mothers or house mothers?
Yes, there were house mothers.
What was their function?
Well, they made sure that the rules were observed. At that time, it was 10:30 at night. The girls were to be in. 12:30, I believe, on Saturdays. We had a wonderful chaperone, a house mother, who I think was off. She had a great deal of dignity, and she didn't meddle in the girls' affairs at all. But if you had a problem, she was apparently extremely helpful.
What did she do to you if you came in at 1 instead of 12:30 on Saturday night?
I think there were penalties. I don't remember.
What kind of social and cultural and academic activities did the sororities sponsor, or did they?
I believe that Dalai Gama's devotion to blind has come later. They currently, especially the alumni, I think are very active in the volunteer braillists and things like that. I don't believe that the groups were as socially conscious in that period as many of them, I think, are now.
When you joined a sorority, did that have anything to do with elevating your social status on campus?
I suppose, maybe. I don't know. Some of the girls took themselves very seriously on that score. I think I had to jump through hoops to be the kind of person I was supposed to be, because I recall I went to a fraternity party one Saturday, and the fellow who was supposed to be the Don Juan of the campus was there stagging it. And apparently he had cut in on me quite a number of times in the course of the evening. And then following Monday, this was probably my sophomore year or something, the juniors and seniors said, "Did you have a wonderful time?" Well, these same people had not commented when I had made the honor roll and so on, scholarships. And I thought, oh, goodness, their standards are not what I really want. But I did, I tried to be, and I bet it probably was good for me. If I'd stayed down, what was it called, the Arden House, down off of Park, and there was a court there. It was an English major's house. I probably would have been even stuffier than I am.
You mentioned honors that when they hadn't congratulated you. You did achieve some honors, some academic honors in your undergraduate days here at UW. Do you want to talk about those for a moment, please?
Well, I was a junior Phi Beta, and I think I was a little embarrassed by that. Back in the, whether it was all through my college career or just the first 3 years, there were numerical grades. And my freshman year, I realized I had taken very, very little science, and I thought physics will probably be the best for me, the toughest, because I wasn't the one person to take ones that I thought were going to be, just easy snaps. So I took that course, and the 6 weeks exam, I got a 65 or something, which just terrified me. But at the end of the first semester, I had a 96, the end of the second, a 98. Now, these are 5-credit courses. And I knew that probably half of the boys in the class came away with better understanding, more thorough understanding than I did. It was taught so that if you knew what we were supposed to study and could write a neat exam, which is what I was able to do, you got this kind of grade. And it's made me very distrustful of the value of grades, because I realized that I wasn't absorbing it and making it a part of me in.
You were simply able to.
Yeah, and that I expected that great big plunk of a grade put me into the junior rank.
I want to have you talk about some of the. That's one of the colorful times on the campus. I have a new spirit on campus that had really been lacking since probably Van Hise's real peak years in 1913, 14, 15, around there. Let's start out with the man who was president for 1 year when you came to UW, and that's Glenn Frank. What can you tell us about President Frank?
I knew him partly from the faculty viewpoint, through my father and my father's friends. I think they did not have very high admiration for him as far as his his being in tune with faculty needs. And I found his own speaking extremely tiresome. He was a bear for alliteration, what so-and-so has so successfully and succinctly said, and he also used a kind of an ABC pattern in alliteration, and it really was.
You're going to have to describe what's an ABC pattern.
Let's see. You'd have it in rhyme, if you have you'd end up with a word antecedent. The antecedent of the book caucus was anticipated by the Brown characters. You would do these words that were so self-conscious.
So it was essentially a trick on his part.
Yeah, it seemed to me. Yeah. I don't remember the students being very keen on him. There were marvelous stories about the Franks as a family and their social life. They were always late by an hour or so to a dinner party, and there was a story about the people who thought, well, they would try to hedge that a little bit, so they invited the Franks at 6:30 and the rest of the guests at 7, and that night the Franks came on time.
something that would happen to me. So he was not a real well-loved figure necessarily.
He was my first experience of a career man hopping from job to job, rather than being deeply interested in. In fact, I think the most bitter person I've ever met about him was a man I met at some cousins up when I went up in Connecticut. This man had been an assistant editor on the Century Magazine when Glenn Frank came in there, and he said that man came in and killed the magazine. It folded not long after his leaving it, but that had been a stepping stone for him.
Did he give any examples as to how he killed it? Or why
he probably did. That is, he was not attached to it, as this fellow who had apparently been with it for 20, 30 years.
So he simply used it as a vehicle?
He just, yeah.
Another person on campus who is said to often be at loggerheads with President Frank is George Sellery. Do you know anything about Dean Sellery?
I knew him quite well, yes, and knew him better because he's also was a neighbor on Van Hise. In fact, we moved in what you would call Dean's Row. There was Dean Sellery, Dean Row, and Dean Burge, the three houses across from us. He was a very brilliant and sharp-witted fellow, George Sellery. And, of course, he would have been the voice of the scholars as compared to the managerial team that Frank was. And I don't remember the substance of his being a particular opponent, but I can understand if he was.
I've had several stories from people who got called into Dean Sellery's office, and they said they can hear their knees knocking to this day. But that despite his sometimes glowering presence, he was a very fair person.
Yes, yeah.
Now we have one of my real all-time favorites for people on campus, the Dean of Women during this, these years, and that's Louise Narden. What kind of association did you have with her?
Oh, I had several first-hand stories. One of them, she was not party to at all. If you know, Dean Narden had a most wonderful cultural voice. She was an Easterner, I believe, and there was almost more of an English lilt to it. And my junior year, one of my very close friends was a senior who was president of WSGA. And so I guess once or twice when I had called Sally, I said, "Oh, Sally, I would like to have you come into my office tomorrow." And one time, Sally answered, and she said, "Come on off it." And it was indeed Louise Narden calling her. Yeah. Then, I had very little first-hand contact, really. But I believe it was her major practice that just shortly before you graduated or during that semester, you would come in and have a serious talk about your future. Well, I mentioned that my older sister, who'd been out for a year, and I were going to Europe for about 6 months. Our grandfather gave us a lump sum, and we actually stretched it for six months. The family thought we'd be gone about three. And so she gave me some very wise advice. She said, of course, over in this country, we are used to very open, free relationship between young men and young women, and they walk out and picnic point together and do this and that. But I have heard from a young woman who was over there last year at the Sorbonne. There was a young man of her acquaintance, an American, and they would go out in the streets and in restaurants and so on together, as they were used to doing at home. And it reached the pass that the young man's associates in the lycée turned their heads so as not to embarrass him by being seen with his mistress. She really told me that story.
It sounds perfectly in character.
Yeah.
It really did. Did she ever, or did you? Was it the story at your time about drinking from the drinking fountain?
I've never heard her say it, but I know it was current. Yes, your lips were too tantalizing when you came up with wet lips or something like that. I guess
it brought the color in your cheek from bending over too.
Oh, was that
it? That would arouse men's
unnatural
passions or something like that.
Oh, she was extraordinary. Though she, you probably have heard. Are we on the air now? Or are you just?
This is being recorded, but this is not going to be used. No, all right.
The story, which I believe was absolutely true, it was when, it was Phil Follett was governor, and Frank was. There was discussion about his tenure at that point. And Louise Narden was asked something about had she spoken to the president and did he agree? And she said, "You can't pin a custard pie to the wall." Mm-hmm. And so she got the right jab that time.
She got a right signal. That's the thing she had in her. That's great. What about, let me give you three names together and see if any of them mean anything to you. Susan B. Davis, Clara Flett, and Zoe Bayliss.
I remember Susan B. Davis quite well. I think she was freshman dean of women.
These were the three assistant deans, Dean Narden.
I can visualize her. She was a short, quite plump, very, very warm-looking woman. Isn't there a hall named after her now? Yeah.
I
don't know that I had any close dealings with her, but I remember thinking she was a particularly accessible person compared to Dean Narden. Yeah. Zoe Bayliss, I know the name, but the middle one I don't.
Now, Claire Flett isn't as well known. Bayliss and Davis will go on being remembered together because there are two houses abut each other on Johnson Street. The Bayliss house and the Davis house.
And those are self-help houses?
Yeah, those are self-help houses. Women's dorms. One of the more interesting higher educational experiments was going on in Madison. Started when you were probably a junior.
Yes, experimental college.
Can you talk for a little bit about the experimental college? I know it was a men's only
organization.
Yes, yeah. And its founder, or its leader, rather, Alexander Mikan.
Yes. Yes, I knew quite a few students who were in it. I can't conjure many names. The magazine of the National Trust for Historic Preservation had a piece just this last issue. Fritz Gutheim was the name of this, at that time, young man. And there was quite a long article about how influential he has been in city planning and preservation and so on. I know that he was... I think I went out with him a few times. There was no real romance at all. He was very serious, and his god was Lewis Mumford at the time. Mm-hmm. We really never talked about anything else. You couldn't. I knew the Micklejohns slightly. He was a delightful person, and they had three sons. I'm not sure that. I think perhaps the middle one was the only one who was here in college.
He was a hockey star, wasn't he?
No. What were their names? I forget. I didn't know them well, but I know that people enjoyed the Micklejohns very much. And I think it was the boys I knew who were in it found it very exhilarating. Of course, it was loaded with about, 5 students to 1 professor in its ratio. And
the characterization I've gathered from other people, and you seem to be saying that here today, is these were very serious students.
Oh, yes, yeah. I don't remember what the selection process was.
I know that several of the students were from the East, and that was controversial, but I know they took several from Wisconsin.
Oh, I'm sure there were some, indeed, yeah.
William Blazer, who went on to become president of City College of New York, from Manitowoc. Things like that. But if you went to the experimental college, I guess the thing was you better be ready to work.
Oh, yes. I think they were very serious students. And probably did not mingle very widely with the whole campus. I mean,
was that a problem, do you think?
I don't know. I've turned up that one name, and it seems to be the only one I can think of, though I believe that, what were the Micklejohn fellows? I think it's the youngest who was an athlete, if you spoke of. I can't think of.
There were also several very distinguished professors who came here for the college and remained afterwards, like Agar.
Yes,
What about the Daily Cardinal? What can you tell me about that? Did you read it when you were a student?
Yes, I don't know that I subscribed to it. But it was quite a lively paper, as I remember.
Was it well-written?
I remember several friends who worked on it. I think it was quite a fairly literate writing.
Let's go to student attitudes for a moment, if we can. During your years on campus from 26 to 30, you started out with the Memorial Union not allowing women unescorted into all but one room. Did you notice any perceptible change in the short 4 years you were here? Of the attitude of the students in the university?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember. That's the only highly discriminatory thing that I recall. During the past week, I remember that even later, when that period when I was the union council, there were never any women who were president of the union, the undergraduates. And in recent years, I think there have been quite a few. There's been that change has been later and very marked. That a lot of those offices are open to women.
When Ted Crabb was sitting in the seat you're sitting in about a month and a half ago, mm-hmm. talking about some of these things, and we decided that World War II played a big thing.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah,
role in that
because there weren't men around.
Yeah, yeah.
The Cardinal had its first woman editor.
That was the first one, yeah.
And then afterwards the doors were down.
Yeah.
What about blacks? Were there blacks on campus?
There were very few, really, I think, and very few foreigners. I mean, Chinese and Indians and so on, as there's so many now. I can't recall, of course. Madison had very few black families when I was young. I was thinking one day last fall, I think, as I was down in the sort of the State Street University area, that the incidence of foreign faces and black faces is just extraordinary now, you know, which is great, I think. You know.
Yeah, again, after World War II is when the foreign students really started coming.
Yes, yeah.
We had another very, some chapters in UW history that are not among the most memorable, occurring starting right about the time that you were an undergraduate. And I mentioned before that we had students from the East coming for the Experimental College. Many of them were Jewish. And anti-Semitism reared its head at UW different times in its history. Did you personally, or do you remember any experiences where anti-Semitism played a role?
I think I remember one that would made me very angry. I'm trying to think of what the... it was... He may have been in Experimental College. Someone brought him to a Delta Gamma party. And there was... It was clear that some of the people did not... And, oh, I was so angry. I can't think of his name. Victor Wolfson. Didn't he? He went on to be quite a distinguished writer, playwright and so on, didn't he? And, it was so clear. I mean, I didn't know him well, but it was so clear that he was so much, much superior to most of those yokels. I said, oh, I bet these same gals, when he's famous and publishing his books and so on, they, oh, I knew him as a... I wasn't aware of it greatly, certainly it was not... I was very lucky. I think that my parents brought me up with absolutely no biases, and that's where it begins, I guess. I mean, in fact, a funny but unrelated story. During the first part of World War II, my husband and I were over in Detroit, and our first boy was about 3 and a half when we went over. And there were race riots over in Detroit that next summer, and we were coming, Steve and I were coming back by train in the dining room of the car. He said, well, what's that black man doing? Here comes a white man with our dinner, with our lunch. And I was so relieved. I thought they'd be, the black man was the steward in his black jacket, and the white man was the black man with a white coat. So I thought, oh, some of the other little children in the neighborhood are doing a black-white image out of it. And if you have children brought up with that, it is so hard to dislodge it.
Let's talk about your father for just a few more moments, because he's one person I really am interested in. He had played such a important role in early development. I mean, he was the early library.
He really was, yeah.
You talked about Music Hall. Now, they moved over to the State Historical Society, what is now the State
Historical
Society. When was that?
Oh, that was way back in about, it was long before my, I think about 1901 or so, that building was built, the Historical Society building. And I can pin that down by the fact that was that the year that the Madison Art Association was formed. And they, of course, had no housing of their own for a long, long while. But they used to have exhibitions in the Historical Society. Yeah. And I think, well, of course, they were still in that building when Father retired. When was the...
Memorial Library was built in 50. That was
yeah,
the after the war.
Yeah.
And they had one side, the right side, and it was facing the building, and that was the university material. On the left side was the
The corridor, the long corridor on the second floor.
That wonderful reading room. For mainly history graduate students at this point. You subsequently went on to have a distinguished career. A distinguished community service career, certainly. You're curator emeritus at the Madison Art Center. You have been for the last several years. You're president of the Madison Literary Society, 88-89, curator of the permanent collection, Madison Art Center, 68-85. Member Board of Directors, Art Center. Member Board of Directors, Madison Print Club. Secretary, Member Board of Directors, Madison Library, 61-70. President, Friends of Madison Public Library, 59-61.
Is this a resume that Judy did for me?
This is the one that Judy did for you. And I could go on, but
No. I think she put me down as program chairman for the PTA one year or something. She certainly learned it.
Of those many activities, which one stands out in your mind?
I've been the most sustaining in the Art Association Art Center group thing.
How did you get involved with the whole? I mean, you're an English major, and I can sort of see the connection to the arts.
That was a deep seated vision. I mean, the visual interest was very, very strong. Am I taking too much time?
No.
I'd been asked to write a little 50-year history of the Art Association, which that was printed in 51. And I was on the board thereafter for a little while, probably 4 or 5 years. And then I was rather out at pasture. And someone asked me if I would take over a volunteer job she was doing, because she and her husband were going to Indonesia. And so I said, well, I would be glad to. And it turned out that Jim Hendon, who was the director, he's the second paid director we'd had down there at Lincoln School, had indeed filled the programming in that room. And I said, I don't blame you. I've done a lot of ghostwriting, but I don't want to be ghosted. I mean, I don't want to have my name on this. But I worked with him, and that fall, the Langer bequest came in, this extraordinary collection that really started us having any hopes of being a museum. And Sham said one day, how'd you like a job? The Langer collection's coming in next week, about 1,100 works on paper. That was just the first part of it. And he said, I can't possibly find time to record it when it comes in. So I took that on and learned on the job. I mean, I didn't have any museum background, but Chim trusted my eye, and he apparently trusted my standards of accuracy. And so I worked from fall of 68 till 85 with the collection, and I'm back there again, right?
That's right. Where I got it. I really think.
The other one is the library board. That was a wonderful experience. We had the, I don't suppose you didn't know Bernie Schwab, or did you by any chance? Mm-hmm. The director, who was just marvelous person. His staff and all of us worked with him. And it was during the period that we were planning the new building, the main library building. And that was fun. I was very active on the building committee and enjoyed that thoroughly for about 9 years.
And you wrote a history of the library.
Yeah, then I wrote that afterward, yeah.
Which I haven't gotten a hold of yet.
Oh, well, I'll send you a copy. I think there are remainders of it.
Does Ralph, do you have any questions you want to ask Mrs. Ela about? Okay. Let's start out. Now we're going to go back, and I'm going to stick you in the invisible narrator again.
Yeah.
Do you recall any particular performances in Great Hall?
In the Great Hall, the performances. No, I'm afraid I don't. I remember the theater very vividly after it opened. Mm-hmm. And I can't recall whether these were... I don't believe that they were the traveling companies, because in the earlier years, famous performers came either to the Red Gym or the Stock Pavilion. Mm-hmm. And as a child, my grandmother took me to concerts. I judged the performer by how he reacted to the Stock Pavilion. They were Paderewski, and some of them were as generous and warm as could be, and Rachmaninoff came in with a... clothespin on his nose. No, I don't recall great performances in the Union.
The Union had a lot of firsts. One of them, they had some of the first art galleries.
Yes.
What can you say, talk about
that? Well, I don't know just when that opened. I know that Porter...
We need a context.
I don't know whether there were art galleries in the Union in the... I think not during my college years. Porter was very interested in the art program, and I'm sure he would have information.
Let's see. Anything else?
How about the Depression Day concert?
Depression aspect relating to the Union.
I don't recall the Depression effects on the university particularly, except that I know university faculty people were better off than they had been in some other years. I remember my mother saying she felt a little guilty that she was not so disadvantaged as the townspeople in industry and in banking and so on, because the faculty salaries did not plummet as some other things did.
This despite salary waivers?
I don't believe there was as large a cut as some people, you know, in things that were more directly competitive.
Ralph, I'm really running out of things here.
That's fine.
It's almost 3 o'clock in the air.
Yeah. Let me just think for a second. I went over the transition sheet, and we did as best as we could on that, I think.
Yeah, we just had one thought here. Did you, in regard to experimental college, did you want to get into it by any chance?
I didn't hear.
Did who? Me?
No.
I didn't hear him.
Well, Ralph wanted to know if you'd have wanted to. If you would have been interested in getting, did you want to get into the experimental college?
I think the experimental college would have tempted me if it had been open. Of course, girls were not even exposed to the curriculum or the idea of choice in it. But as I heard about it, knew about it, it seemed to me particularly stimulating.
Did it ever occur to you that it was that you were upset because you didn't get into it?
Oh no, and you said that didn't open until 28, was it? I was thinking it was 27, 28. Well, I had finished 2 years of college. Then I would have had to retrench to get in if I had been able to open the door.
You mentioned earlier that the Memorial Union, that it had sort of upset you, that it had upset you that women weren't were permitted in so few areas. Mm-hmm. Did you or did any of your friends, do you recall any of you feeling that same way about the Experimental College?
I don't know whether freshmen would have resented not having Experimental College open to them. There might well have been more talk on that level, since it was a 2-year course only. As a junior, I suppose I didn't even think of it as a prospect. Yeah.
Past that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I think that's. Okay, you're an alumni member of the Union Council, and you were a Trustees Association. Why don't you start off by talking about the alumni member of the Union Council?
I was a member of the council from, I think, 1953 to...
Let's start over, a member of the Union. Start over right now.
Yeah. I was a member of the... an alumni member of the Union Council from 1953 to 57. I believe that would have been two-year terms. And we met once a month, as I recall, and it was very lively, good fun. The adult members did not do a great deal except enter in with advice and questions now and then. It was the reports of the various committees and their planning. The one thing I do recall is that toward in the second term, there was the influence of PR had come into the students' thinking to quite a degree. Of course, it has saturated everybody at this time, but there was a little discord or a little holding back from the alums and the faculty on some of the projects that we thought were just bubble dreams. And I recall that because I gave the speech for the departing members at the last banquet and spoke of that, how I wasn't surprised that they were infected, but I wish that they would learn that if you opened a restaurant and you had Billy Graham write the publicity and Picasso do the drawings, and people came and you served them rancid butter, it just wasn't going to work. And I have a very strong feeling still about how everybody blows everything up with publicity. And then I think our roles were simply being a little sounding board to the students. There's some very bright and delightful students during those 4 years. Enjoyed it.
What about is that the Trustees Association?
Yes, it's the Memorial Union Building Association, I guess it's called. I don't recall. I served on that for a long while. It was, I retired recently and I'm now called a voting member, but it seemed to me I'd been on too long. The duties were not at all arduous. You met once a year, usually in October, for a general meeting for 2 days, Friday evening and a Saturday or so on. There was a group that made decisions on building changes and financial investment in the building. I recall one committee that I was on with it, that it must have been in the early 70s when there was a good deal of student unrest, and there were a very nice man whose name I cannot think of, who was the chaplain at St. Paul's University Chapel. He and several of us and some some student groups too had been trying to find ways to deflect anger on campus, and I enjoyed that. That was a committee appointed by the trustees, but it was a small committee. Otherwise, it was chiefly just going to hear financial reports, and very, very congenial group. But I didn't feel that I was ever doing any shaping in it.
Okay, take it away. We're going to end this interview right now. All right. Officially declare, call it over.
Well, wow. I enjoyed it. I was so tired when I came in. I thought I was going to be just, you know, collapse.
That's the microphone.
Yeah.